watch cartoons. We'll take a look back at where we've been. So let's hop into our time machine.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Cartoon Time Machine. I'm Scarlett.
I'm Katie.
We're your animates, and today, at long last, Katie and I are going to be talking about a series that I really came a little late to the party, but got really, really into, and I don't want to speak for Katie, but I think we both are in agreement. It's a very good show. Blue Eye Samurai, the animated series currently streaming on Netflix, just one season so far, but with a promise of more to come, and it is really great. If you, like me for a while, have heard people hyping it up, but not, actually seen it, I think it's fair to say, the hype is earned. It is as good as people are saying it is, and possibly even better. I really enjoyed the show, Katie. How about you?
I also really enjoyed it. It was one of those where I went in very much not knowing what's happening, and being told to watch it and going, well, now it's on the schedule, so I must watch it.
I like forcing you to watch shows that I want to talk about for like a long time
also
by just putting it on the schedule.
It started right in, it was the second show I watched in what is now my watching Asian cinema category again, which started unfortunately by actually watching live action Avatar and going, well, I like Asian representation media, but I don't like this one that much. So let's go to other places. Then watching Blue Eye Samurai and then watching other things.
I'm glad that some good came out of the Netflix Avatar
We got series. That and the fact that there are new fans to Avatar that we can convince to watch the animated show.
Are there, though? I don't know.
There were people who definitely never heard about, but Netflix has really been pushing the show. I'll give it a go. And then they'll be like, it was okay, but I'm kind of like, I kind of like it, but it's not great. And then you just go, consider this. This is good.
You just had the we have Avatar at home version, and you can have the actual takeout Avatar.
You can go to the Michelin star restaurant.
Yes.
And then go to your favorite ice cream shop afterwards by watching Korra. And then you'll finally feel full.
I hate to break it to you, Katie. I don't think the Avatar fandom will ever feel full, especially not after Korra.
These new people. This is not the show we're discussing, but I'm making a whole metaphor.
It's a good metaphor, and yeah, to your point, not what we're discussing. But I think there is some shared DNA here. Like, I think in, you know, not just in the sense that these are both Asian inspired cartoons made by Americans, although thankfully Blue Eye Samurai is able to correct one of the worst aspects of the original Avatar series, is that they don't really have a lot of actual Asian voice talent in there. Certainly some.
That was the first thing I did while watching Blue Eye Samurai, was looking at the IMDb cast and going, please, please. Oh, okay, we're good.
See, to me, the wildest thing is that there is one voice actor who, like, his first appearance, you're like, oh, wait, like, why'd they get that weird-sounding white guy? And then it's like, oh, no, wait, that is actually a very well-known Asian actor just doing a weird voice. But yeah, it's a great show with a lot of love for Asian, specifically Japanese culture. I'm not a person who knows a whole lot about that, but I'm just gonna take a wild leap because seeing this cartoon really made me want to go to Japan. And I learned a lot about Japanese history and culture from this show, even though it's not necessarily trying to be the most historically accurate thing. I definitely have a desire now to learn more about this period in Japanese history, which again, I did not know much, if anything, about going into it. It seems to me that they really went into this wanting to make a show that is really is celebrating this culture and this history, mm-hmm. and is telling a story that is steeped in that culture, not necessarily one that is you know, told through an American lens.
And is an homage to, like, it's definitely homage to 70s and 80s, like, Japanese film. Especially with, like, how ridiculous it is.
Oh,
just
yes.
the era of those films, and then also, like, Chinese kung fu films. Just that, like, it's all based on something, but we're gonna turn up the, like, the magical realism a lot here.
For sure, right. It is very stylized, especially in these fight scenes with the samurai. And yeah, I mean, parts of it, you know, make me think a lot of, like, you know, Kill Bill, which
I was gonna
makes
say
sense.
There's one very direct comparison I think of American film playing homage to stuff, and that's Kill Bill.
Yes, and I think in many ways this is paying homage to Kill Bill, or at least the same films that Kill Bill itself was inspired by. So it's, yeah, it's great. But yeah, Katie, do you want to give a brief summary of what the show is about, or would you like
No,
me
that's
to?
my favorite part to make you do.
That is fair. So yeah, the show takes place in the Edo period. Edo period. I think they went back and forth how they pronounced it. Edo, which is roughly the 17th century in Japan. And the main character is a warrior woman, a samurai by the name of Mizu, and her she is a mixed race. She is half Japanese, half white, and she is basically spends most of this first season out on a quest to kill every white man remaining in Japan, as one of them is likely the one who sired her and therefore set her on a life course of being an outcast and a freak in a society that values blood purity. And yeah, along the way, she makes many friends, including best boy Ringo, who is the best boy in the whole wide world, and I love him. Also, Princess Akemi, who's played by Brenda Song, is also perfect. And
here
Taigen.
For the Brenda Song revival period we're in.
I'm so happy that she is getting lots of voice work, because I adore her in Amphibia. Like, she makes that show so hard, and she's also great here. I want to nominate her for Best Disney Princess, even though there is no connection to Disney here. I think she's great. Every time she was on screen, I just wanted to say yes, queen, even though she is a princess. And like I said, also Taigen, who is playing the role of General Shang in this retelling of Mulan, which is how I'm going to choose to see him throughout this entire thing, is just little bits of gay panic the entire time.
Oh, I 100% just a confused bisexual.
Such a confused bisexual. I love him so much. I love all these guys so much. With the exception of our sort of big bad of the season, Abijah Fowler, who is the Irish man who Mizu is most directly. He's Irish, right? Is he Scottish? He's Irish.
I think he's Scottish. No, he's Irish, but he's
Irish,
but
Kenneth
he has
Branagh.
A Scottish accent, mostly, it feels like.
Yeah, it's. I feel like it.
But he is Irish.
Yeah.
Because he talks about what the British did to his people, and it's specifically
right.
talking kind of like the atrocities of Ireland, it seems.
And right, and I think also
but he sounds much more Scottish in my brain every time.
And I think that's part of just like Kenneth Branagh himself having a, I think, kind of muddled accent, because he is, I think, from Northern Ireland originally, but I think he also lived a lot of his life in like England-ish. Yeah, so I think maybe that's
resulted. I feel like
the
last name Fowler also to me always just, I think, just reads more Scottish than Irish. I don't know why, but it does.
Maybe. Yeah. The Wikipedia says he is officially Irish, so
yeah, no.
In
Definitely
any case, the point
the
is he don't belong. He's not supposed to be there in Japan smuggling in weapons and making life hard for the locals. Yes, Katie?
A white man.
A white man, yes. God, but he was so good. I mean it's Kenneth Branagh. They hired a renowned Shakespearean actor for this role, And they let him just run with that gravitas. Like that scene where he's sitting in the church that like they built for him, because they're like, it reminded me like when you have like an animal in captivity and you're like, well, like we should create enrichment for him. Here's a thing for you to climb on. Like they just assume that he needs a church. So he's just like basically praying to Jesus and being like, yeah, I will kill as many of these people as you want, and then you can deal with them when they're in heaven or hell. Like that's so funny to me and so intimidating at the same time. He did such a great job. This is a killer voice cast all around,
Oh yeah, it's an
with the
incredible voice
possible
cast.
exception of Randall Park, because I don't know what he was doing. Like his weird voice grew on me after a while, but I have utterly no idea what he was going for.
That is a comment I've read a couple times of what was happening here?
Like, Randall Park has a pretty normal voice. Like, I think he just has your standard American accent, and like it didn't sound like he was attempt like the most of the actors have American accents. Like, that's sort of how Japanese is represented in this show, is the people who are Japanese just sort of have an American accent, and then Abijah Fowler has his Irish-ish, Scottish-ish accent.
An accent of some quality.
You get a sense of otherness. You get a sense of a foreign presence there. So, like, with that being said, I don't know why Randall Park felt the name to change his re felt the need to change his regular voice when he could have just done his usual American accent, just like everyone else is doing their American accents. I don't know why he's like, you know what he does? He sounds like when Benedict Cumberbatch is attempting an American accent. Like the really high pitched and nasal of it. It's like, what, why? Like you are American. You do have a normal speaking voice. You could have done that. I
Yeah.
don't know. I did get used to it after a while and began to accept like this is a character with kind of a weird voice, but like when he started speaking, it was so jarring. Like I missed what he was saying at first, because I'm like, what is this voice? This sounds so out of place in this world.
Yeah, it really didn't get me too much, but
But in any case, yeah, I think it's a great voice cast. And everyone just gives it weight. Like there's an earnestness, I feel like, to everyone's performances in this show that makes everything seem so much deeper.
It's all very well emotionally portrayed in voices.
Yeah, I mean, you feel like for all these characters, like all of them are in really rough situations. Like you've got like Ringo, who like doesn't have any hands, but he just like wants to be useful. He's just kind of tagging along after Mizu, just try. He doesn't care that she's a woman. She's in disguise for most of the show. Most people, again, sort of that Mulan comparison. To travel as a samurai in this world, she kind of had to disguise her sex, so she's going around dressed as a man. But Ringo knows, and he doesn't care.
I was going to quickly describe it as sexy Mulan, and then I went, I feel like a lot of people will just go, so Mulan.
It's not that. Like there's like a slow burn enemies to lovers thing going on with her and Tigen, who
Your
is
favorite trope.
my favorite trope. And it's like it hasn't like officially happened yet. This show does a really good job, I think, of like the subtleties of like developing relationships. Like right now, like on paper, I'd say the two of them are still enemies, but like, boy, are they coming close to lovers along the way. They spent a good chunk of like the middle parts as like reluctant allies, because both of them have a vested interest in like going to save Akemi and destroying, Abijah Fowler. Like they both have reasons to be allies with each other, but they hate each other the whole time. Except do they? Do they though? Or do
Hateful
they love each
passion.
other? And unlike Mizu's ex, Tigen actually respects strong women. So,
Yeah,
like,
that man fumbled. You don't
but
want a
yeah,
strong woman to step on you.
I think it was like roughly after that moment that I realized, wait, Tigen doesn't know she's a woman, right? Like there was a moment I was thinking like, wait, did I
Oh
miss
no.
like the
He's
reveal?
having bisexual panic the
Oh.
whole time.
For sure, bisexual panic in a society that is not, and I think is explicitly said to have some real taboos about that. Because we see, yeah, sorry, go on.
I think all three of the main characters are having some bisexual panic in their hearts.
For sure. For sure. There's a very early scene, I think in like the first or second episode, I think maybe the first episode, where Mizu sees Akemi go by in a carriage and, or like a whatever those things are called. Like, is it a palanquin? I guess it's a palanquin.
I think it's a palanquin.
Like a little, you know, carts being held up by humans, not animals. That's like my like heads up version of describing the word palanquin, I think. Yeah, they're like eyes meet just like suddenly, and I'm like, oh, so is this gonna be our relationship? And like, not really, but is enough. There could be a love triangle here.
It has its couple moments here and there where you're like, a little spark, and then it's like, oh god, the embers, this one's on fire.
It is a very sexually charged show. I will say that, like, both in the sense. So one thing, like, you know,
I'll never see some things the same.
Disclaimer, like, if you're going into this thinking like, oh, cartoon, or even like, oh, the rating is because there's going to be blood and violence. There is blood and violence. There is also fairly explicit sex, I would say, more so than I feel like I've
quite
seen
explicit.
In Invasion. Yeah, like
and also at one point, a phrase I said. You can bleep part of this if you want. This is, I think, at some point just going to turn into another explicit podcast episode. The phrase I had to say was, there are tens of dicks on screen. Tens! And then the friends I was telling about the show went, tens?
There were a lot of dicks. Yeah, okay, maybe this is going to have to be an explicit episode, because I feel like we're not going to, we can't not talk about some of these dicks. So
I was... knowing you, I was a little surprised with how much you loved the show, with just how sexually explicit it is.
It is not our type of media. The moments at which it was about to lose me, I'm usually not a big fan of that. But I feel like it was, I don't want to say it was tasteful necessarily, but like,
I don't think it was. Like, I think it was plot relevant.
I was going to say, it's plot relevant. Like, I think, like, there is a large portions of this show take place in a brothel. And, like, specifically a brothel that, like, they say, like, caters to peculiarities. And what that sort of amounts to, I mean, first of all, there's weird stuff because it's Japan, so there's tentacles. There's that. There is that.
Unfortunately, yeah.
But also, there's, like...
just remembered.
There's also just gay. Like, it's like, okay, like, isn't it nice that, like, you know, there have always been, you know, a need for there to be places where, you know, people can act on same-sex attraction, like, acknowledging that, like, this didn't just pop up in the last 50 years, no matter what, you know, your usual, you know, Republican asshole would say. We're explicit now, I can say that.
We're like, explicit, yeah, officially.
Like, it's always been around.
There's a phrase that I was gonna add a phrase to that, and we're gonna move on.
Yeah, but like, I think it leads to some like good, again, the show being very good at just like, you know, the micro expressions of like, you sort of see Mizu sort of absorbing that, and like, I think having the realization that like, while she is weird, she is not alone in that. Like, she, her, you know, being a woman who is not very comfortable with what womanhood means in her society. Not saying, you know, that, you know, she's like trans or anything. It's more just like a sense that in this society, she has to present as male to do the things she wants to do and be her true self. So I feel like it's important that we also acknowledge all the other people for whom society in this world has not carved out a place for. And so they have to sort of conceal their true selves. I think it's important to see. I think it's good to see. And then there's stuff like the squids, in which case it's just like, you know, whatever. It's weird stuff is happening here.
This poor octopus.
Or the kabuki masks.
I'll never see that mask the same again. You don't have to keep talking.
We can move on. Painting this picture in your brain, and in the brains of all of our listeners who know which scene I'm talking about. But yeah, no, it's Yeah, there is a lot of explicit stuff, but also it is, you know, I think that it is not there to be titillating and purely that. There is
And part of it
you are
is
getting
it's
character beats from that.
and part of it is also staying to homages to Japanese culture and art. Japanese has a history of, even from that time period, erotic art styles. I want to say it's Shibuya or Shibuga. There in the 1700s, there's a explicit there's an erotic art style that is directly referenced multiple times in the show. It's
I
like,
didn't
ah, what a detail.
I
I'm
mean,
scared.
it's I feel like this show would have done its homework on that for sure. And yeah, it's also not surprising. Like, that's some of the oldest works of art we have, period, are like explicit graffiti. Like, the humans have always been exactly the same, is what's interesting about going back through like art and culture, is that we like the same stuff. Our interests don't change that much. We like violence and sex. That's kind of the human experience in a nutshell.
I got the word. It's Shunga. That's the art style.
Shunga. Okay, cool. I'm glad that your search history has that, not mine.
Yeah, unfortunately, Japanese erotic art is now it art style is now unfortunately saying that is in my search history.
There you go. You wrote that in such non-sexy terms that I feel like it's okay.
You can tell I was looking for a Wikipedia article specifically about Japanese art.
Yeah, it would be crazy to like plug that in actually looking for something titillating.
Unless that's what you're looking for, because it is erotic art.
I mean, yeah, but
Hey, you aren't history majors, you get to have some things too.
speaking of art, we would be remiss if we did not talk about the absolutely gorgeous animation that this show has to offer. I think the word sumptuous is what comes to mind for me. It's just so pretty. I love it so much. I love these landscapes. I love it takes place mostly in winter. So you have which I think I mentioned during our winter cartoons episode. There's just so many beautiful blues and whites and grays and contrasting like birch trees against the snow and steam rising off of hot springs. Like, they really create an atmosphere with this show, and I love it so much.
It is definitely atmospheric.
And
They
I feel like
do a
that
lot
wasn't
with
fully
a
expected.
sim, and it's not even like a very, it is simplistic in a lot of ways, but they do that so they can really detail specific things. It is
Exactly.
detailed yet simplistic in a way.
I think they have done a very specific type of stylization that works very well for what they are trying to accomplish. You get some like kind of cool like little trippy dream sequences and the like, and it's you really get a sense of Mizu's headspace throughout. And I love this, like the contrast of the blood on the white snow or the rain, and the colors of the different characters. Like, Mizu has a color palette that's like very blue, hence the blue eye samurai that she is. Some other characters are defined by greens or reds. Like, it's just very, very stark against the backgrounds, and the animation itself is very fluid. Fight scenes are incredible. Oh my gosh, these dynamic fight scenes, some of the best camera work I've seen in animation. I really got to shout out the camera team. That's one of the really nice things about working with CG, is that you can have really interesting camera work in a way that traditional animation does not always afford you the ability to do. I was wondering what you thought about that, Katie, given that you are a cinematographer, as we say.
No, the fight sequences were all very, very much dynamic, and I actually really enjoyed a lot of the talk about the sword fight stuff because it really is. This is where I get to be a nerd for 5 seconds because I have started taking sword fighting classes. Now they are the Western sword style, but it also like it's as silly like in both areas, like some of the things, just like the names for the different techniques, which we get some of that, and I really enjoyed like all that detail and like watching the sword, because sometimes you'll go, oh, that's not a technique you would ever use, and it's like done for fun and just make things look fun and exciting. But other times you're like, oh no, those are actual, like, that looks like a normal sword fight. But it was just like, yeah, no, that checks out with in Italian, like you have a Dente Shinyata, which is translates to boar's tooth guard. So you have stuff like that. You have boar's tooth, guard of the lady.
Guard of the lady? That feels appropriate for Mizu.
Posto di Didona. Get to the good Italian accent for the producer. I'm sorry to all Italians. I just had to insult our producer a little bit.
Yeah. So somewhere Rachel has just gotten a shiver down her spine. She doesn't know why.
Yeah, but I don't know. Sword fighting's a cool thing, and this was fun sword fighting. But also, like, fun weapons. Claw hands? Cool.
Oh, that whole fight. I mean, that was from episode 5, right? The best episode.
Yeah, I think that was 5. I think that's, the triple storyline.
Dude, episode 5, I think you and I talked about this briefly before, but, like, after I saw episode 5, I had, like, sort of, like, the revelation that, like, okay, I don't know if the show, I can say, as a whole, is better than Avatar The Last Airbender. It's probably not. I really adore Avatar, I think. And, to be fair, it had 3 seasons, so we'll see how Blue Eye Samurai goes. I think that this is a very strong start out of the gate. I think there's real potential here. However, I think that episode 5 of Blue Eye Samurai is better than any single episode of Avatar The Last Airbender.
I think it is one of the best animated episodes I have seen in a while. Going back quickly to the animated fight sequences, though, I just want to add in that all fight sequences for me now are held up to the standard of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem, which I have to say has some of the best animated fight sequences I've seen in a long time.
That was pretty great.
Yeah, those were great. These were good. No, episode 5 is some of the best animated 20 minutes I've seen in a while.
I just feel like it had everything. Like you alluded to, the 3 storylines coming together, the use of kabuki theater as a framing
device. It's not kabuki.
It's not kabuki?
No, this is bunraku.
Bunraku. Ah, thank you.
It's specifically a puppetry style, which I we constantly come back to puppetry on this podcast because puppetry is essentially, when you think about it, the first form of animation. We got animation from puppetry.
Very much is. I mean, if we want to get a real film school about it, if we talk about the first use of media studies being Plato's Cave, that was a puppet show. So I think we can tie
Plato's
all of media back to puppets.
But yes, puppetry is always important. And we have watched several animated films that are partially puppetry.
We should have. As soon as I saw that, I was thinking Katie's gonna love this episode.
And I went, puppets! But also, it's a type of puppetry that's so creepy because there are just, it's a real type of puppetry where there are just people in these, like, full black outfits and creepy masks running the puppets. I'm like, you're in my nightmares. You are the hat man.
The levels to which it, like on a story level, like this is like the writer in me just like falling in love with the way they told this story, because like it is there are so many levels, because on, you know, they're telling a folk tale, which, you know, on the surface level is very similar to the story we're seeing, which is about a vengeance demon, essentially an onryo, as they call it. I've heard a little bit about that through other, you know, the Japanese monsters are terrifying, so I've come across stories before. But like in a symbolic way, we sort of see our protagonist, Mizu, becoming something of an onryo in her quest for vengeance. But you know, so the story itself is sort of reflective of that. But like going deeper, like the puppet show itself, like Mizu spends most of the show basically acting, you know, out as, you know, being a puppet of Fowler, whether she knows it or not, acting sort of in the way that he expects, and, you know, following the path that has been set out for her, that she sort of feels or is helpless to go along with. You know, she can't just set down her quest and, you know, go have a happily ever after somewhere. She has to go out and follow along what the storytellers have, the quest that has been put aside for her. I don't know, I feel like there's a lot you can read into it, and I love all of it. And the way that the puppet show just works its way in and out of the story as we see her make the wrong choice by the end, and and the fight scenes, it's so good. And the backstory, she could have been happy. I both hate and love stories like that. It reminds me of my favorite Batman movie, Batman Mask of the Phantasm, which similarly is interspersed with a backstory in which we see basically the one time Bruce Wayne could have settled down and been happy had fate not interceded to ensure that he would go down a dark path of vengeance. They sort of do the same thing here. We see the happy life that Mizu could have had, and you watch it and you think like, oh, like, why can't they just work it out? And, you know, even though you know it's a flashback, so you know where it's going, you know that it's not going to be, it's not actually going to be, you just watch it, you're like, oh, but why can't she just be happy? Why can't he just love her and the two of them be happy together?
I'm not going to lie. I zoned out for a lot of that because I was trying to figure out what other Unrios have been in media.
Please do. I was just gushing. I was like unintelligibly gushing about how
much I caught a little bit of it as I was deeply trying to figure out to make sure this was correct. The ring, the girl in the ring is an Unrio.
Oh, is she?
Is
the Grudge also one?
I didn't get that far.
Maybe.
Sadako, the main character from Ring, the vengeful ghost spirit, is an Unrio.
That makes sense.
There's your other take on an Unrio, really. There are other ones, but that's really, I mean, that's a very large franchise.
Yeah, I mean, Japanese horror is amazing and scary.
And I don't watch it because I'm terrified.
Yeah.
I don't like horror. I'm a little baby.
So I feel like The Grudge isn't officially an Unrio, but I feel like it follows its create. Oh no, it is. She is. It's just not, it says it later in the description. Okay, cool.
We got there. Famous Unrios in history. I'm zoned back into this podcast episode now. Mizu could have had a happy life. You're so right. Who did it? Who was the one responsible?
It's an interesting whodunit, but also it doesn't matter kind of thing.
It doesn't matter. Like, they both betrayed her in different ways, if and possibly so.
And I feel like the realization is basically that like neither of them really loves her. So like she was either, there was no correct choice. Like she would not have long term been happy had she believed one or either of them. Like she finds her long lost mother only for her mother to be, you know, just as bad as every other person in her life. Like, she thought that, you know, she'd finally found a savior, but not that. And, you know, she was, at first you think, you know, she's, you know, being married off essentially. So us with our Western storytelling are like, oh, he must be a monster and she'll, you know, break free from him. But then it's like, no, actually he's kind of a good guy. And they slowly like develop like a nice rapport and relationship. It reminded me a little bit of like Belle and the Beast getting to, you know, fall in love with each other. And then that's taken away from us too. And you just kind of see, like, that whole sequence just tells you everything you know, need to know about how Mizu became the way she was. Like, and we thought,
I think it's just the episode before. I think it's the ending of episode 4 is really that. I think the moment of truly understanding a deep look into Mizu's psychology of like, okay, nothing's going to stop her.
No.
She is fully throwing her morals out of a 15-story window and watching them fall on the ground.
Yep. Nope. She.
That was a rough end to an episode.
It was, right. I mean, because it's again that Western ideal. Like, we expect Mizu to be, you know, a noble paragon. You know, we expect her to always find the righteous way out of every situation, and time and time again she acts selfishly. She is
absolutely not a hero, definitely an anti-hero at best,
that's questionable,
kind of a villain.
I mean, what I really like is that like there's really not much of an attempt to say that, like, her quest to kill Fowler is for the greater good of Japan. Like, we, the audience, I think, kind of see that it is. Like, we see that he is a bad man who allowed to go, you know, unfettered through this world will bring war and hardship to just the everyday people of Japan who don't want the guns he brings. Like, it's definitely an anti-gun kind of story, very much a cautionary tale about what happens if you flood a peaceful, or at least honorable, I'd say, society with an dishonorable weapon. But from Mizu's point of view, he just could be her dad. It's so someone described it as like murder Mama Mia, I think, online, which is pretty much true. She's she's got four men in the world who might be her dad, and she is going to kill all of them. And I love this for her.
Mama Mia. You
want someone to recut the trailer to Mama Mia, but have it be Blue Eye Samurai.
We'll get someone on that. We'll put out a call.
Someone make this for me and me specifically.
Wild, I want to wild see it. After our other single art call of Muffin and Plank. Now, Mama Mia, but Blue Eye Samurai?
I think it would be very cute.
I know what I'm getting you for your birthday this year.
It beats the other edit that I've been mulling over in my head, which is how can I recut Loser Baby from Hazbin Hotel, but it's King Andreas from Amphibia talking to a child. it's not good, but I keep thinking of it for some reason because Keith David has such a great voice. I want too many edits and I'm too bad at editing, so I think
just need to learn how to edit again.
I think that's key. I think that's something I need to do.
You went to film school. You know how to edit a little bit. We had to learn to edit. Now, did we have to learn on Avid, a program no one uses? And we tried to tell them.
A program that no one willingly uses. There are still people in Hollywood who are forced to use it because their larger studio bought a subscription like 20 years ago and is insisting on continuing to use it. But no one actually likes it.
Now, is that why they were like, it's the industry standard, use it? And we went, no, it's not. Only some people still use it.
It's like the old studios use it because they bought like a 50-year contract 20 years ago and they're gonna wait that thing out.
Do I use Avid anymore in my life? No, I don't.
So, Katie, while it is true that they taught us how to use editing softwares, and I feel like I could do the edit, the one thing they did not teach us how to do is illegally download content and have it be in a form that I can put into an editing software. So I don't actually know how to do that. That is my problem.
Okay, we did not take the same editing classes. I did learn how to illegally download several things to edit.
See, I only took the 101 course. I only took the basics where they already had everything downloaded for you.
Now, are the sites a little sketchy and you should vet them? Maybe. But do I know a couple good YouTube to MP4 converters? Oh, yeah.
Ever since Kick YouTube went down, I have no idea what I'm doing with my life. That was the best back in the day, though.
What I'm trying to say, kids, is don't illegally download content.
Yes, don't do exactly. It. Kids, don't do the things that Katie is saying you should totally do.
Do not pirate contents from small indie companies.
Only pirate from large evil companies.
I wasn't gonna say it. I'm not telling you what to do with your life, kids. Commit crimes, don't commit crimes. Legally, I will say don't commit crimes, but I mean, I'm not your dad.
If one of our enterprising fans out there wants to leak Coyote versus Acme into the world, I'm not gonna say no. I will take the heat for it. It will be worth it to me. I will take the jail time if it means I can see Coyote versus Acme.
Again, legally, we are partially a comedic podcast. Please do not take anything we say at face value.
No, take what I say at face value. I am no longer doing a comedy podcast here. This is a call to arms. Someone leaked Coyote versus Acme. I don't care what the consequences are.
Okay, legally, I care what the consequences are. I'm telling you don't do it. If you want to listen to Scarlett, I've given you the warning. I have no liability in this situation.
We have gotten so off track.
Excuse you, it's our podcast. What did you expect? No tangents?
That's true. We have all the tangents. Yeah, what else
Miss,
is there to
my New
talk?
Year's resolution is no tangents.
I did not make such a resolution.
You did. I will find the clip.
Did I say no tangents?
You said no more tangents for 2024, and I said bet.
I don't know why I would say something like that. I must have still had have been nursing a New Year's hangover when I said that.
So going back to Blue Eyes Sam, right?
Yes.
Where were we?
And what else is there to so we talk a little about the voice acting, we talk a little bit about the show, the story. I mean, yeah, I feel like there's some spoilers I guess we could get into, but I feel like it's almost not necessary.
No.
The finale is
Yeah.
baller. Like everything about the show is baller. It looks so good. It makes me really excited to see where they're going from here. I think they have a confirmed season two. It's just we don't know when that's gonna be.
Not
Hopefully.
until at least a year or so, I think. Not until 2025, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, animation takes forever, unfortunately, and I'm happy to let them cook. Like they made an incredible work of art here, and the stories were meticulously crafted. The performances were definitely, no one's first take was used. I feel like I can say that with some confidence. Like they spent time crafting these performances, crafting these characters. Boy, do I love everything they did here. Like this show is just it's I can tell. Like it unless there's like some kind of serious drop off in quality in season two, which I very much doubt, this is going to be one of my favorite shows of all time. Like there's it already is. Like it's that good. I like it better than Arcane. But I think it's sort of in a similar quality area there, especially when compared to Netflix series. Like I think this is a really good example of what Netflix can do when they just give their money to the people who know what they're doing and willing to take risks on something like this. Like this is not adult animation in just the edgy adult joke sense. Like they just made a work of art that is animated and they use the medium to the fullest of their potential, which
And that's
as
our favorite
creepy as
thing about animated stuff is when they use the medium to progress the story.
this story could not be told anywhere near the quality in any other medium. Looking at you, live action Netflix Avatar. Sometimes the original medium it was designed for is the best way to tell that story. Why do we keep operating under the principle that like you can just casually turn animation to live action with like no real changes? Like they're different mediums. God, damn.
CG, and if it's all CGI in the end, it's still animated. I'm looking at you, Disney.
That is true. That is definitely true. Let's
The
see it happen
2019
a little.
Lion King is animated. You can't call that live action. A
They
single
can and
character
they
is a real
will.
lion.
Boy,
Actually,
weren't they
no,
great?
this year Mufasa, which I believe is also the same CGI, right?
Oh yeah, same. It's like full on a sequel to the Lion
But
King remake for 2019.
It's no longer be touted as live action. They are touting this one as animation.
Are they really?
Last I checked, it's on like their animated schedule and stuff like that.
Okay.
I
I
have not seen
mean,
it as much called a live action. I have seen it called animated.
well, good, because it is. There's
Because it
nothing in
is.
there that's real. Like,
There are two hills I'll die on. 2019 Lion King is live action. And I hate the naming convention of the Star Wars movie. Why franchise? Why is there the Clone Wars and Clone Wars? It's so confusing. Which
I'm
one's
glad
which I'll
that you have
never
those very
remember.
specific hills.
I'll
Yeah.
never remember.
That yeah me neither. I actively can't remember as we're talking about it.
I can't either.
But yeah, no, it's animation as a medium is often disrespected, and that's why I love that we have things like Blue Eye Samurai that just clearly adore the medium and are looking to find ways to push it and tell stories using that to its full advantage. Like Episode 5 could not be told in live action, I don't think. I mean, I don't want to say never, but like the use of the puppet show, I feel like would not work anywhere near as well if they had been live action. The fight sequences, like the amount of stylization in those fights needs animation. Like, you can't, I mean, the closest thing is Kill Bill, and yes, those are incredible fight sequences, but I think maybe it's blasphemy to say, I think these fight sequences are better than the ones in Kill Bill.
It's a lot harder to choreograph real people with fake swords than fake people with fake swords.
Exactly. With animation, your fight sequence can look exactly how you want it to look. There is absolutely no limits other than your imagination. It will look exactly the way you want it to, provided you have the artist talent there, which they do. I think they got the most talented people currently working in the industry to make this thing. Or if they weren't before, they trained them into it. Like, I imagine for any artist, having Blue Eyes Samurai on their resume is a great stepping stone to further things. I'm excited to see all the things that this team goes on to do. It's Blue
Awesome.
Spirit Productions, is the name of the production company. I think it's a French production company, and I haven't done much research on them, but
Definitely.
I have to wonder if that can't be a coincidence that their name is Blue Spirit. That has to be at least partially Avatar inspired, right? I don't know. Maybe I just like to think that.
I don't know.
It would make me happy to think that.
You
Because
can.
I think there is inspiration here that has been taken from Avatar of what if we made a more adult-oriented version while sort of still keeping a lot of the similar themes and some of the similar look. It's really good, y'all. I don't have anything else to say really about this show other than if you haven't seen it, for sure go watch it. I do not. This isn't even like it might not be some people's cup of tea kind of thing. If you love animation, if you're listening to this podcast because you care about animation, I think you'll like this a
If
lot.
you're very intrigued by 17th, 18th century Japanese culture, and you don't want to watch Martin Scorsese's Silence because it's so disappointing.
Or if you've all caught up on Shogun and are trying to scratch that itch with a similar show.
I gotta watch Shogun and then I gotta watch some Kurosawa, but Kurosawa is eight, often 3 hours, and that's a lot of hours.
Yeah, definitely a lot of inspiration of that there here too. But to be fair, what Western media hasn't been at least a little bit inspired by Kurosawa? Come on. Like, it almost
At
feels like
least
it's cheating to say that something is Kurosawa inspired.
it's all Kurosawa inspired.
It's
I
all
was having
Kurosawa.
this internal debate about who are the most famous Japanese directors, and the question is Miyazaki higher than Kurosawa now?
He's approaching it, but I don't know. I feel like when you have kind of formed the basis of like film storytelling, it's kind of hard for anyone to beat that.
It's really who comes third.
Who would come third? I don't know, and I
I don't
clearly don't
know,
know enough.
Honda Ichiro's up there, creator of Godzilla,
Okay,
and
there you go.
really the forefather of mega disaster films with Godzilla. So,
That
and
would
there's
do
some,
it. You know so much more about foreign film than I ever will, so I will bow to your expertise.
thank you. I'll be here all week. We do live in the time machine, unfortunately.
That's true. You'll be here at all times because that is how time machines work. You are here, you will be here, you were here.
I'm the ghost of past, present, and future.
How man, why haven't we done ourselves like a Christmas Carol episode one Christmas? We should do that.
I know
We've set
just
ourselves
the
up so
person
nicely.
to get.
You're gonna traumatize
We'll call in our ringer, our
her.
Christmas Carol expert,
We have a Christmas Carol expert. It's true.
who next week at this time, when this episode is out, will text me immediately going, no.
No. I don't we don't need to reopen yearly trauma.
But who else knows how to judge Christmas Carol so perfectly?
I mean, no, clearly they are an expert in the field. I think they will not deny that. It's more, it's like, when you bring a person out of retirement, you're like, you're the only one who can solve this case. And you're like, no, I'm retired. Like that's what it's gonna be like.
I see, I see. Well, any other thoughts about the show that we actually, I don't know if we spent the majority of this episode talking about actually.
we got a good chunk of it. I think we spent a decent amount of time. I feel like I've said everything I need to say. I've hit my main points.
Yeah, I think so. Since we're not
I got
doing
to say
super.
enemies to lovers, so that's all I really needed
Yeah.
to say.
I think I got all the like non-spoiler talk out of me. I'm just thinking about episode 5 still.
I know, me too. I might actually just go rewatch that. I have so many new things
Yeah.
I need to watch, and yet my heart is telling me rewatch episode 5.
All you do is you just rewatch that on loop and listen to Has Been Hotel playlist. I know your life.
You didn't have to call me out so hard, Katie. Wow. Wow. I feel so attacked. All right, I'm going back in the time machine now. I don't need this from you.
We both live in there. I'm coming with you.
I put up a divider with a little sign that says stay out.
Aw.
Yeah.
It's not a very thick wall. I can just talk to you through this.
No, I'm in my quiet place. You can't touch me in here.
I'm gonna
Anyway,
move
thank
on
you
from
all
that
for
statement.
listening. Thank you all so much for listening. I'm going into my quiet place inside our cartoon time machine. I'm Scarlett.
I'm Katie.
We're your animates, and we will see you next time.